It's Saturday and sunny, and I'm 14 years old. I should be outside playing with my friends, but instead I'm cruising through the picture-perfect streets of Oak Bay with my parents. We're moving slowly, scouring the sidewalks, peering up driveways, when my dad finally spots it. We pull up to the house, and behold, a dozen folding tables covered in knickknacks, bunch of boxes overflowing with magazines and garbage bags stuffed full of used clothing. On the lawn, there's a sign that reads, "Garage Sale," and believe it or not, I'm excited. You know how they say that one person's garbage is another person's treasure? I'm excited about what treasure I might find here. My dream is that I will stumble onto a rare comic book, look at the homeowner and say, with my best poker face on, of course, "How much for this?" And this poor unsuspecting homeowner will say, "Have it for a dollar." Now, on this fateful day, it actually happens. I'm flipping through a box full of books when I find it. Not Spider-Man number one. What I find is much more valuable than that, though not in monetary terms. It's a book called The Power of Myth. And on the cover, this serpentine dragon is poised and staring at me with that special kind of intensity in its eyes, as if to say, "I dare you to buy me." So that's what I do. I retreat to my parents' car, and I proceed to examine my loot, hard-earned after a day of hunting. Now, I admit I don't fully understand much of what I read. At times, I find myself scanning the same few lines over and over again, frustrated by my inability to comprehend. But there's a small part of me, a silent part, that recognizes that there is power hidden in these pages. So for the last 21 years of my life, Joseph Campbell, the man who wrote this book, has remained lodged in my mind. For much of that time, it was in the background, but in recent years, I've returned to explore Campbell's work, and I've found new depth and clarity in the words, ideas, and methods that he put forth. As I see it, Campbell offers a way of looking at stories that reveal new layers of meaning and practical insight into universal human themes. Now, I hear you asking in your heads, what does this have to do with myth and the hero's journey? There's only one way to answer this question. We have to embark on the adventure together, here and now, my friends. So are you ready to leave the ordinary world behind and to plunge into adventure and mystery with me? Are you ready to discover the hidden and heroic powers that dwell within each and every single one of us? Did I mention you don't even have to leave your seats? All right. Awesome. So, I've missed a few slides. There's Joseph Campbell for you. And after a lifetime of studying mythology, Joseph Campbell said something very interesting. He said, "Myths are stories that never took place, but are forever true." How can that possibly be? How can a story that never took place be forever true? Well, here's Exhibit A for you, The Boy Who Cried Wolf. Now, let's get a show of hands if you think that this nameless boy actually existed at some point in history and that he actually was eaten by a wolf. I knew there was going to be a few of you in the crowd. We are UUs, after all. Okay. So how many of you believe that if you cultivate a reputation of dishonesty, people will doubt you, even when you're telling the truth? Right. So that's how a story can be true, yet never having taken place. Now, Campbell believed that myths and legends contain similar insights dressed up as fiction, and that all these ancient tales of adventure are, in fact, early attempts to pass on psychological truth through veiled symbolism. Campbell also recognized that most of these stories adhere to a consistent sequence of events and cast of characters. And this regardless of their place and era of origin, which I found very fascinating as a 14-year-old boy. He came to look at these consistencies as a narrative pattern of sorts, and he called this the hero's journey. He asserted that by recognizing this pattern first in our own lives and then also in stories, we can tap into the power of these narratives that we love so much. So here's a really brief outline of this narrative structure that I'm talking about. It starts off with the hero in her ordinary circumstances. Once established in this environment, she's called to adventure and then usually shoved or coaxed beyond the threshold and into the great unknown. Next, the hero progresses along a road of trials and challenges. She meets new allies, picks up new tricks, and finally comes face to face with the defining challenge of her story. Sometimes the hero perishes, only to be born again. Other times, the hero overcomes this challenge and succeeds in her endeavor. Having achieved the object of her quest, the hero returns to the land of ordinary circumstances. Only, it's no longer ordinary, because the hero has been transformed by her journey in the great unknown. So why does awareness of this little pattern allow us to tap into hidden powers? Because as I already said, the hero's journey describes a process and events that occur internally within all of us. They are like maps to the inner world of the psyche, which, as some of you may know, is extremely difficult to explore without one. So to be clear, the hero's journey isn't about a particular hero traveling to unknown lands, slaying dragons, collecting treasure. It's about you and I journeying into ourselves and slaying the monsters that may be lurking there. Maybe we can rescue repressed aspects of ourselves, things that we have hidden away or tried to minimize over the years. And then, of course, we come back out transformed. So Campbell himself described the journey like this: where we had thought to go out, we shall come to the center of our existence. Where we had thought to be alone, we shall be with all the world, because we're all on this journey together. So in case you hadn't noticed, we left the world of ordinary circumstances about, I would say, 3 minutes ago. We're now officially on the road to adventure, where we'll encounter three stories that embody the pattern of the hero's journey. At each stop, we'll look for a little bit of treasure, an insight, a truth, or a lesson that might help all of us navigate our daily lives like the heroes we truly are. So, without further ado, stop number one. "Another Elsa!" I exclaim upon seeing her for the 10th time last Halloween. I turn to my wife. "Why are so many kids still obsessed? It came out 4 years ago." Did I mention my 2-year-old is dressed as Elsa right now as we speak? The next time my kids asked to watch Frozen, I decided to sit down with them. I'd already seen it more times than I should probably admit to you here and now, but I wanted to confirm a suspicion that I had. And sure enough, I soon recognized it. That familiar pattern I just described. Cleverly modified and hidden beneath the layers of narrative, but there nonetheless. Now, the clever portion of this movie is that it actually has two heroic journeys. Elsa and Anna each embark on their own individual paths, and of course they reunite at the end. But depending on which character you follow, you're going to get very, very different insights from this movie. So today, I'd like to focus on Elsa's journey, as it contains a very important lesson for people of all ages, and especially for our friends who are coming of age and nearing the threshold. So just to give you a quick recap in case you've been living under a rock, Elsa, no, I'm just kidding, or unless you don't have children and grandchildren. Elsa discovers at a very young age that she isn't like the other kids. She has a special gift. And at first she embraces this gift and she shares it openly with her sister Anna. But then one day this gift backfires and Elsa accidentally puts her sister in a coma. Anna recovers. Spoiler alert. And she doesn't even remember this traumatic experience. But Elsa can't seem to forget it. She's overwhelmed by guilt, pressured by her well-meaning parents, well-meaning but misguided, I might add. She becomes a recluse. She hides in her room all day, every day, and avoids all human contact. Instead of learning to master her special gift, she suppresses it ruthlessly. And because this gift is tied to her emotions, well, She tries to suppress those as well. Is the lesson coming into focus yet? A little bit, maybe? In the movie's most contagious song, which I will not sing, but I will read the lyrics to you, Elsa says, "The wind is howling like this swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in. Heaven knows I tried. Don't let them in. Don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal. Don't feel. Don't let them know. Well, guess what? Now they know." To me, Elsa's story represents the individual struggle to be who and what they truly are in a world that wants them to be something they're not. In the face of peer pressure, social pressure, institutional pressure, it's very, very easy to adopt Elsa's strategy of conceal and repress. In my personal experience, this strategy is unsustainable. As Carl Jung, the psychologist, once said, "What you resist not only persists, but grows in size." And sure enough, when Elsa snaps, after years of resisting and denying who she really is, she freezes her entire kingdom in the middle of summer. Talk about growing in size. But what if my friends don't like me for who I am? What if being myself sends everybody running the other direction? Well, the movie's climax, which you saw masterfully reenacted here today, answers this question. Because after years of ignoring Anna and mistreating her, who saves her big sister when push comes to shove? Right? So, despite repressing and ignoring her sister, Anna sacrifices herself to save Elsa, which to me tells me that the people who truly love you will be there for you, no matter what. And if they don't like the real you, then they don't deserve your company. There's the beautiful frozen Arendelle. All right. So any discussion of the hero's journey is incomplete without at least one Star Wars reference. The original films are the first to be consciously and purposely scripted to fit the hero's journey. George Lucas contributes much of the film's success on rewrites he made after reading Campbell's book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And he even calls Campbell his Yoda. So there you go. Now the scene we're going to explore today opens with Luke Skywalker, flying an X-Wing into the heart of the Death Star. Ooh. His goal, to fire a single missile into a hole no bigger than a womp rat, which I assume means it's a very small opening. And, of course, this is to blow up the Death Star, a weapon of galactic mass destruction, you know. So there's only one problem, though. At this point, Luke has already made a pass at it. He's already fired off a missile, and he missed. And his X-Wing has state-of-the-art targeting systems. I mean, this is like the best technology you can get. But the shot is so hard, even the targeting system can't make it. So Luke, now he's going for his second pass. He's flying along a narrow trench. There's crossfire every which way, and he doesn't think he's going to make it. And that's when the ghost of Obi-Wan Kenobi chimes in and says the following: "Turn off the targeting computers, Luke. Use the Force." Ooh, I get chills when I hear that. So Luke does this. He flips the switch off. He goes in blind. In the background, you hear a frantic voice screaming, "Luke, your targeting system is offline. What are you doing?" But Luke, he's calm. He's zen-like as he flies down this narrow trench, pulls the trigger. Oh. And blows up the Death Star. Hey! There it is. Beautiful. Thank you. So where are my fellow overthinkers in the room? Who here is an overthinker? No, people are not being honest. Yes, thank you. Okay. So to me, the insight in this scene is for all of us specifically. It's for everyone, but I think for overthinkers especially, okay? So how many times have we been overwhelmed by information and paralyzed in our decision-making? How many times have we lain awake at night, staring at the ceiling, while the mind circles some problem, real or imagined? To me, this scene conveys the following. Sometimes logic and reason only take us partway. Sometimes we have to move beyond the intellect and rely on something deeper and more ancient. Personally, I call it the primordial mind. But you can call it intuition, instinct, your heart, or that still, small voice within. Sometimes in life, the best course of action is indeed to turn off your computer and use the force. All right. The third stop on our magical adventure. Another classic, The Lord of the Rings. Now, last Sunday during her Easter sermon, Shauna said that great teachers don't merely give us information. They show us how to be good people. Notice she didn't say they tell us how to be good people. They demonstrate. So with this in mind, let's move into our third stop here, and it's the Fellowship of the Ring. And our focus here is not actually going to be Frodo, who's considered to be the hero of this journey by most. It's actually going to be Gandalf, who, like so many other well-known figures in cinema and literature, plays the part of mentor figure. It's his job to train, assist, and guide the hero on her journey. And there's one lesson of paramount importance that the mentor has to teach the aspiring hero: how to stand firm for something greater than oneself. In the Fellowship of the Ring, Gandalf the Great teaches Frodo this lesson at a crucial moment. The lighting's a little hard there. They're surrounded by orcs, these monstrous, mean creatures, and they're fleeing through this underground city called Moria, and they cross over this skinny little bridge. Everybody makes it to the other side safely, but then a great, big, fearsome monster called a Balrog shows up, and this thing is bad news. And Gandalf realizes this. So now from the onset, Gandalf has been telling Frodo how important his mission is to destroy the One Ring and save Middle-earth. Faced with a do-or-die situation, Gandalf's words give way to grim silence. Like all great teachers, Gandalf proceeds to show rather than to tell. He knows that this monster, if it crosses the bridge, will put an end to the entire Fellowship of the Ring. So Gandalf turns around, stands upright, drives his staff into the ground, and yells, "You shall not pass!" More goosebumps. Now, this is, granted, a very extreme example, but I think that for me, I'm faced with these types of decisions on a regular basis. I'll explain. I can think of many situations in my own life where I've had to choose between speaking my truth or staying silent, acting on my principles, or flying under the radar. If I speak up or act out, I might very well spoil friendships, damage my career, or tarnish my reputation in the eyes of some. But if I stay silent, I feel like I've betrayed myself somehow. So Gandalf's example here, to me, says that I should pick my battles carefully. I don't need to make a stand on every bridge I cross. But when I have identified an important cause and it's time to stand up for that, I have to be ready to dig my heels in, look that thing right in the face, and tell it, "You shall not pass." Well, this is a difficult lesson, hard to put into practice in my experience. All right. Well, my friends, our adventure has just begun. But alas, from here we must part ways. My time is up. I encourage you all to continue the journey, to delve deeper into yourselves, and to see that the hero is and always has been you. Here are some parting words of encouragement from Joseph Campbell himself, who started me on my own adventure all those years ago. "We have not even to risk the adventure alone, for the heroes of all time have gone before us. The labyrinth is thoroughly known. We have only to follow the thread of the hero's path." Thank you.